I believe that the role of sales engineer is one of, if not the most important job in the rapidly growing technology industries, says our today's special guest. And we couldn't agree more, of course. So let's have a look how you can deal with it in your daily business.
My name is Tim.
I'm Jan. Together we are Sales Excellence.
This is your podcast for software B2B sales and pre-sales.
We believe in a strategic, value-based and customer-centric sales approach.
With our knowledge and experience, we would like to help you find new inspiration and more success in your daily sales lives.
Yeah. So with that, I really like that statement, the opening statement, and what potentially a lot of you from the audience of our listeners faced a lot in the past is that pre-sales has only seen as a technical resource, or how we would say, demo monkeys, right?
The bad and word, demo monkey. Yeah,
the very, very, I can't use the other word, so we need to be,
yeah, right.
We need to be serious today. So there are very, very high expectations, right? We haven't seen a real kind of education available in school or university for pre-sales in respect of enablement. We recently learned that in Germany there are some tracks available for sales, but I haven't seen pre-sales, to be honest. And another thing is that the role is often not established on an eye level with other stakeholders like sales, right? So back to that demo monkey issue. And to really master pre-sales or the role of pre-sales, I believe it could potentially take years, right, to really master it. And so putting all these things a little bit into consideration today, we got another great guest. And with that, over to you, Mr. Pulmer.
We do have a great guest. Before we introduce our guest, I would like to have one slot for housekeeping. We haven't had housekeeping for a long time, but I have something to say here for a change. And so the shout out goes to Markus Tirok. He's a German coach. He's going to assist us taking this podcast, our recordings, etc., to the next level. And he said one thing that made me think a little bit, which I would like to address now. He said, "Hey, when I listen to your podcast episodes, it sounds like you're trying to sell something, right?" And I really want to clarify that if it wasn't clear already. Jan and myself, we're obviously doing this out of fun. We really just want to share our experience. There's no marketing program, no products, no coaching, nothing that we sell. We do this for the sake of fun, for the sake of sharing. And with that being said, I have one ask to you, dear listener. If you like this today's episode, for me personally, I think the greatest compliment is you can leave a comment under our episodes. We always put everything up on LinkedIn. That is the main channel for us. If you don't follow us there, please do. And if you like this, or if you have something to say, or if you don't agree with something we said, please leave a comment. That is the greatest thing. We would like to interact with the audience, and that is your chance. And with that being said, let's introduce the guest. Today we have Chris White, and I'm going to say a few words. So he has been in the IT industry and software industry basically since the 90s, started out as a programmer, consultant and software architect, and then has continuously grown his career into like direct and VP roles and strategy, product, and of course, pre-sales. And yeah, with that being said, welcome Demo Doctor Chris White. How are you?
I'm just great, guys. Thank you so much. Thank you for having me. Yeah, just I love what you're doing and just delighted to be here.
Awesome. So I became aware of you a couple of months ago, unfortunately only then, when I saw on the Pre-Sales Collective that there was a webinar called The 6 Habits of Highly Effective SEs, right? And I think you're also an author. I didn't say that in the intro, but you have written a book with that heading. And for me, that was immediately attractive. And I guess that is a bit of a marketing spiel on your side maybe, right? Because there's obviously some resemblance to the Stephen Covey book, which I love. Right. And indeed. I think what you probably tried to do, and this is where we're going to get into in this episode, is that you sort of tried to map these habits against the dedicated profession of pre-sales. And that's really the plan for today's conversation. Before we go into that, one personal question to you, right? So as we just heard, you were in previous roles, VP roles, but at the same time, you have also had your sort of self-employed demo doctor coaching and training, entrepreneurship, so to say. So you did both, right? Being employed and doing that. How did that work for you? Did that result in any conflicts? What was the benefit of that? And I know that you also recently decided to full-time concentrate on that coaching business, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's an important question. And interestingly, I mean, I'm asked this a lot, and I know another number of people who are sort of doing the same thing. So just a little bit of background. I got into the role as a sales engineer about 15 years ago. And a lot of people have heard me say this. I thought I was going to be brilliant because I could talk and move a mouse at the same time. And you know, I discovered very quickly that there was a lot more to being a sales engineer than just being good in front of an audience. And I'm the first to admit, and I talk about this a little bit in the book, I took a few lumps early on, but I figured it out. And I learned what it meant to be a sales engineer. But it's like every time I felt like I figured out one aspect of the job, I sort of ran into another challenge. And over time, that's sort of how the six habits evolved. And it's interesting. About 5 years into that part of my career, I took over a sales engineer team and saw that they were making many of the same mistakes that I was making, but there was no training. This was about 10 years ago. And that's when I first created some sales training, was for my team at the time. Well, that training evolved into the book that was published about, you know, a little over a year ago. And then ultimately, you know, has become this business. So to answer your question, I was sort of doing both. I was afraid, frankly. I was afraid to jump. I sensed that there was a need in the market. In fact, I believed for a long time that the sales engineer role is the most underserved role in the sales training and the sales enablement space. And I had a great deal of confidence in my material. I'd had the opportunity to test drive some of my material in speaking engagements with Red Hat and a few other very large companies, and it was very well received. But the idea of sort of going all in on a consulting business and giving up that paycheck, so to speak, was very scary. So yeah, I did demo doctor on the side for about 3 years. And then the time, you know, everything just sort of happened all at the right time. Ironically, a little less than a month before the pandemic, I decided to go full-time demo doctor. Then the pandemic happened, everything shut down. And the interesting thing, guys, and I feel very fortunate, very blessed. Business has actually been very, very good, even in the pandemic. I think there's a lot of organizations that are still not only struggling to improve their sales process, but committed to investing in their sales engineers and in their sales teams to improve the way they engage with customers. So anyway, a long answer to a short question, but you know, simply put, I've been wanting demo doctor has sort of been an idea or or sort of a burning thing inside of me for almost a decade. And its time finally came. And so far things are going very well.
Awesome. Yeah, that is a great success story. And maybe, I mean, this is just an assumption, right? But I think a lot of companies obviously are now working remotely, which means any type of presentations you do would have to be facilitated virtually. And maybe that has risen the consciousness that there is potential hidden in there, which has then given you the opportunity to come and provide the skills necessary, right? Oh. Whereas maybe on-site meetings, the consciousness wasn't right there because there was nothing to make up for. But now there is, right?
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting. I mean, and I'm sure you guys see this in your work, that there's some aspects of doing things online that are actually better than meeting in person, right? The fact of the matter is we can actually be, for better or for worse, we can be more productive. We can do more meetings in a day. And I think a lot of us are starting to hit, quote, Zoom fatigue. On the flip side, it's that much more difficult to obviously to read the, quote, read the room. You don't have the body language. You know, hopefully people do videos so they can at least somewhat sort of sense, you know, facial expressions and that sort of thing. It's harder to express yourself. You guys can tell I'm, you know, I tend to wave my hands.
Yes, the listeners won't be able to see, but
exactly. but it's that it really is that much harder to engage. And there are very specific things that, that need to be done in the virtual world. So I do think that's part of the driver as well, for sure.
And with that being said, maybe that's it's time to shift gears and go one level deeper. I don't know, Jan, if you have anything to comment on. Otherwise, I would say let's go into the six habits, shall we?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there was a question, why does your heart, Chris, beats for pre-sales? But for me, it's already answered, right? Because I mean, I can hear and I have the pleasure of also being able to see your passion about it.
Yeah. Indeed.
I mean, you label your business the demo doctor, right? Which obviously puts an emphasis on demo. That being said, spoiler alert, of course, and this is very much the same sentiment that Jan and myself share, is that obviously it's not all about the demo, which is really why there are six different habits. And let's start with the first one, I would say, right? And you made the effort to sort of put them in an, I have to remember my German lessons, but there's a construct in the language where you put everything with the same, starting with the same letter, right? And you've done that, right?
Yes. I think we call it alliteration.
Alliteration. That's the word I was looking for. Thank you, Chris.
Yeah.
So let's go through the six alliterations here and start with partner.
Yeah. You know, I think I may have even shared this with you guys, and certainly I wrote about it in the book. When I first got into the role, I didn't necessarily think of myself as being in sales. In fact, I chafed a little bit at the idea that I was in sales. And to me, I was just the technical guy there to deliver the message, right? Present a demonstration. And I discovered sort of along the way that in fact, my job is, I am in sales, and that really is my primary job. And what I've come to realize is sales is a team sport. And it's very easy for us to look at our sales counterparts and frankly, not understand what it is that we're looking at, right? I mean, we are simply wired differently. And one of the mistakes that I think we make is that we see and interpret things the way we would think of ourselves or how we would project it on ourselves, when in fact, you know, what they're saying or what they're doing or vice versa is just coming from a completely different place. And I'll give you a perfect example. When we answer questions, we being sales engineers, we answer with precision. Whereas our sales counterparts, they do what I call round up, right? They tend to just round up and they tend to answer in a way that is favorable. They like their answers to be perceived as favorable, right? Well, when we hear an answer that's sort of vague, we think, well, they're lying or they're exaggerating. And in fact, they're not lying or exaggerating. They're just rounding up. They're just giving their interpretation and they're looking to us to give that level of precision, right? So in many cases, we don't have a communication problem. We have an interpretation problem. It's how we interpret what we see and what we hear, right? Mm-hmm. Here's the reality. So we wouldn't even have the opportunity to show up and give a presentation if our sales counterparts weren't working hard to open doors, prospect, right, find the right people, navigate through the organization. On the flip side, many deals, certainly if we're involved, wouldn't close without us achieving the technical win. But then nobody gets paid if they don't navigate through procurement and actually close the deal. So this is such a team game, and that partnership is so critical, and it's so easy to get it wrong. So that's why the first habit is to really view our sales counterpart as precisely what they are, is they're our partner. We are teammates. By the way, does that mean we always agree? Of course not. Does that mean we always get along? Does that mean there's not going to be conflict? Of course not. Right. What it means is that we're in this together. And if we need to put a difficult conversation on the table, let's put a difficult conversation on the table and figure it out. Right. Mm-hmm. So let me pause there. Does that resonate with you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. There's a couple of points I would like to pick up on, and maybe I'll start with the last one first. Mm-hmm. I would even argue that if there is no friction at all between the AE and yourself, maybe the result is not the most optimal one, right? Because you just require different viewpoints and perspectives on the matter to come to the most optimal result. So I would say some friction is healthy for the end
result. Yeah. Really good point.
And you talk about interpretation of obviously things that are being said within the meeting, but I'm also thinking around the lines of how the pre-sales role is interpreted by the organization itself, right? I mean, it's a firstly also mindset thing, right? Do I see myself on eye level with my AE counterpart, or do I submit myself to, hey, Tim, next week demo, right? Or do I engage in the conversation and start qualifying and maybe questioning a few things? But also from the organization level, of course, there needs to be some empowerment that you are allowed to have these type of conversations in the first place, which then means interpretation on organizational and hierarchy level.
Yeah, you're so right. And one of the things that I do when I run workshops, particularly, and now I'm running workshops with both SEs and AEs together, and one of the first things that I do is ask them, what are the characteristics of an effective partnership? Where there are three words that always rise to the top. Can you guys guess what those three words are?
Communication.
Communication is one.
That's the one I would have said.
Trust.
Trust is two. There's one more. You guys are nailing it.
I'm blanking.
Respect.
Respect.
Communication, trust, and respect are always the top three. And I've done this a lot. Yeah. And it sort of ties back to what you were just saying, right, is the view within the organization. I think more and more organizations are viewing the sales engineer role as more critical, right? More respect. And as a result, I think the sales teams are respecting one another. And by the way, and this is one of the things that I tell the sales engineers, please, you need to respect your sales counterparts.
Oh, yes.
Like until you've walked in their shoes, until you've carried a bag, right? And had to call the same prospect 10 times just to get the meeting, right? Do not, you know, look at them in a bad light. Their job is just as hard, if not harder than ours.
Yeah. I mean, I completely agree on that. So I also faced the situation where we as pre-sales people just said, oh, the stupid sales guys, right?
Yeah.
And I mean, there are stupid salespeople as well as stupid pre-sales people in some cases, but I completely agree with you. So you should definitely be aligned. You should get an understanding for your counterpart. And also, I would even say it's not just the salespeople, right? So it's maybe also the success manager guy. It's, I don't know, the sales development rep starting even further. It's maybe marketing, because you get involved into whatever campaigns and you need to support a webinar or you need to be on a big roadshow, all these things. So, I mean, I guess sales is the stakeholder we are most in touch with, but I also believe there are much more roles besides sales, and they all can help to win the deal for the company. And I think the same principles would apply to these other roles.
Yeah, I'm really glad you mentioned that, Jan, because, and I'm the first to admit, when I talk about habit number one, to partner, I am primarily talking about our sales counterpart, but you're absolutely right. And one of these days, I'm sure I'll come out with a second edition and I'll emphasize the point that we need to be partnering not just with our sales counterpart, although arguably that's the most important, but you're absolutely right. Post-sales, right? The professional services, customer support, customer success, marketing, the product. I mean, in fact, I think that's one of the unique things about the sales engineer role is we're sort of right in the middle, sort of touching all these places. So could not agree with you more. By the way, that's one of the things that makes this job so exhilarating, right? Is we are sort of right in the middle of things.
Yeah, absolutely agreed. So maybe that is now a good point to move to the second habit. And I would say with the second habit, you're preaching to the choir here, because it's called probe/technical discovery. And obviously, Jan and myself, we always talk about discovery a lot. In fact, it was, I think, one of our first episodes that we even recorded on this very podcast, because it's so dear to our hearts. And maybe I'm going to open up that point with a question to you, because you've chosen those specific terms, right? Technical discovery. And I would almost argue, okay, well, of course, I'm a big friend of discovery. I would say technical discovery is, of course, important, but I would even say it maybe goes beyond that, right?
Yeah. No, and I really appreciate your question, Tim, and you're absolutely right. In fact, I had the opportunity to speak actually a number of times with John Kerr before I published the book. And in fact, he read the book before it was published, and right, he provided some feedback to me. And he, that was one of the big things he called me out on. He, first of all, I use the term technical win a lot. And he said, I got an issue with technical win because I think it's, you know, a win is a win. And then he also said, you know, I struggle with just calling out technical discovery. And I get that. So, you know, what I said to him was, when I use the term technical discovery, first of all, I do think we need a distinction between the discovery that we, the sales engineers, would do and the discovery that our sales counterparts would do. So mm-hmm. I think that's a first distinction, number one. Number two, does that mean that we're only looking for technical details? Of course not. The very first thing I talk about is objectives, right? What are their objectives? Was there a compelling event, right? Or a business driver that made that organization reach out to us, or at least agree to the meeting, right? What does success look like for them? So we need to understand that so that when we put together our demonstration, it aligns with what are they trying to accomplish. One of my favorite sayings, and I don't recall if I've shared this with you guys or not, is he or she who buys a shovel doesn't want a shovel. They want a hole. But they don't just want a hole. They want a fence or they want a tree. But they don't just want a fence or a tree. They want privacy or they want shade or they want fruit, right? But we're so in love with our shiny shovels and we just want to show up and talk about the shiny shovel, right? Nobody cares about the shiny shovel, right? However, if I don't do the discovery to really understand what are they trying to do, right? What are they trying to accomplish? And now which one of the tools in our toolbox do we need to get out and show them, you know, how that solution is going to help them get to where they're trying to go, right? Then I don't know what to demonstrate. So that's why, and there's if I may, and then I'll pause, because obviously this is a hot button for me as well. I think technical discovery is important for a number of reasons. But one, our sales counterparts, they won't ask the questions that we'll ask, nor should they in most cases. They also won't hear what we hear, nor do they know how that really translates into how we should demonstrate. Third, customers are reluctant or may be reluctant to tell our sales counterparts some of the technical details we need to really show a compelling demonstration. So I think it's just critical for, again, we go back to habit number one, right? The partnership needs to be in place. And I think as much strategy needs to go into discovery as it does the demonstration and the presentation. So let me pause there. That was a sort of a long-winded answer again, Tim. But does that sort of give you sort of my picture of technical discovery?
Yeah, it sure does. And I would like to pick on one particular point. So you said, of course, we as pre-sales have to sort of, let's say, focus. I'm not saying exclusively, but the focus is the technical discovery, whereas the AE, our account executive sales counterpart, is focusing on potentially more business-related discovery, right? Absolutely. One situation that I have also faced is, I mean, you will always work together with people that are not on the same experience level as you are, right? I've been doing this now for sort of 10 years, and sometimes I work together with people that have been doing it for 1 year or 2 years, and then I'm working together with people that have been doing it for 20 years, right? So there's a huge bandwidth. And sometimes I face the situation that I'm thinking, okay, I really would like you, dear account executive, to ask this type of question and maybe do this type of research, such as read the quarterly report because it's a stock listed company type of thing, right? That for me is one of the no-brainers because it will tell you a lot about where the business is going and what they're facing. But that those type of thoughts are not necessarily at the AE level. So I also see myself I feel responsible to sort of inspire these type of ideas if I see that it's maybe not there, even though I'm maybe not responsible entirely for the actual activity itself.
Yeah. I think you're touching on something that's a real challenge for seasoned sales engineers. And that is when we're paired with maybe a sales counterpart, an account executive, who maybe is not as seasoned or has as much experience either in the role or maybe with that organization or, you know, with that within that industry or something of that nature. And you're right. Even though I think the natural perception is that the sales individual, right, the account exec sort of is the leader and the sales engineer is more sort of the supporter or the follower, if you will. And I've found myself in this role many, many times where I'm almost in a sales enablement role with my account executive, right? Where I'm actually providing some guidance and some strategy and some leadership, just because I've been doing this for 5 years or 7 years, and I've seen a lot of these deals and these customers. And I think when we're faced with that, we just need to handle that with a certain amount of grace and maybe, you know, some delicacy, for lack of a better term. But we shouldn't also shy away from that. Is that sort of in line with what, you know, kind of what you're talking about, Tim?
Absolutely. I like the point of handling it with grace, right? I mean, we all need to be a bit humble, I would say, right? We all start at some point, and it can be a great course of learning from each other, right? Even though I'm maybe working with a salesperson that has been doing the job only for 1 or 2 years, I'm sure they still have their own viewpoint, which then in the end will mean different perspectives result in a better outlook.
Yeah, absolutely.
Jan, would you like to add something from your point of view, or shall we move on?
I just love listening to you guys. So, and I agree. I mean, it's interesting because just the word technical triggered that kind of conversation right now. I mean, I truly believe we are completely on the same page. And basically, it's not just technical, but technical is important as well. And I think the last point you guys made, I see it the same way, right? So if you realize, hey, the other guy is maybe not on the level you would expect him, you should try to help him, right? And try to assist him. But I think it's also important, so the meeting is over and you go home together or whatever. So have that conversation with him, right? So give him your point of view, because you had an expectation and he missed your expectation. So give him really the chance to improve the next time. And in some cases, maybe it's also valid to say, hey, let's have a chat with your manager, because it's the responsibility of your manager to bring you to that level, right? So the sales managers, they should also constantly coaching the people. I believe we are able to do it. And I mean, I would say almost we like to do it, but we also need to make sure that it will be not too much for us, right, on our team.
Yeah, we shouldn't speak out of turn, so to say, right?
And that brings me back to Chris, habit number one. So if you have that kind of team alignment and trust and respect, I think you will be able to have these kind of conversations, right? In other environments, it would be maybe a really tricky and critical one, because the other guy would always think, oh, yeah, you are the bad guy, right? You're telling me what I'm doing wrong, or you're telling me I'm not knowing how to do my job. But it's not like that. It's really about, hey, I think here is room for improvement, right? And I really like to provide feedback. It's your decision what you make out of it. But I mean, I would only like to work in environments where I feel like I can tell what I think in a respectful way, of course. And that gives all of us the ability to be better the next day, right?
Well, and I, Jan, I love what you're saying, and we're sort of skipping ahead a little bit, but you really just outlined habit number six, which is to perfect our demo, which is great. I mean, and I love, by the way, I love the fact that you tied it back to habit one, right? As we go through the habits, we're going to see that each one really, it builds upon a foundation of the partnership. And at the end of the day, I could not agree with you more. The best opportunity to coach, teach, and learn is after a lost opportunity. It is the best time to have that conversation. And by the way, let's use the term sort of grace and humility again, right? The way I like to put it on the table is I open with a question. How do you think that went? What do you think we could have done differently? In fact, what could I have done? I'll start there. What could I have done differently to produce a different result, right? That makes, look, I'm completely and totally open, right, to anything that you have to say, right? That makes it, we're in the safety zone now. Now, if I may, here's some thoughts that I have, right? Jan, I completely agree. Having that habit of consistently and constantly going back and debriefing and discussing, you know, opportunities, deals, meetings, et cetera, powerful.
And there's one thing that actually Jan said recently in a conversation with a colleague of ours, and he said something like, please provide us feedback and we're not looking for the response. You did great.
That is interesting. That
helped quite well and triggered a response that was sincerely helpful.
Yeah.
So it's just a matter of choosing the right words to ask the question to not end up with, yeah, Tim, you did great.
I love that.
And moving on.
Indeed. Like as if to say, I'm not looking for a pat on the back. I'm not looking for, someone to stroke my ego. Like I'm sincerely looking for some feedback so that I can actually even do better next time. Yeah, I love that.
Yeah.
Well done, guys. Well done.
So we sort of jumped the gun a little bit. So I would say habit one, partner; habit two, probe. Check, I would say. So let's move on to habit number three, right? And I know that Jan will be very happy to hear it because one of his favorite sentences to me is, Tim, it's all about preparation. And you call it, Chris, you call it prepare content versus script. So maybe you can guide us through the meaning of that.
Yeah. And it's interesting, guys. Each habit was born out of a mistake that I discovered I was making. I sort of went through these stages, right? Stage one was, I didn't even think of myself as being in sales, right? And the guys that those crazy, sales folks that I was working with, like I didn't even understand what a sales process was, right? And then finally, I got my head around this notion that I was in sales and had to accept that, wow, like we're on the same team here. Like I need to, start engaged. But then I just started just throw stuff on my calendar. I'll show up, right? And then I realized that, guess what? I can't just show up and be the smart guy. I had to do some discovery before I went in. Well, now that I'm starting to do some discovery, what am I armed with? I'm armed with information that will help me build a better demo. So what did I start doing? Building better demos. I burned lots and lots of time, spent lots of time creating these magnificent, heavy demos. And guess what? More times than not, the stuff that I spent hours, if not days working on, were never viewed by the customers. I was building a demo that would probably take a day to actually get through for a 45-minute presentation, right? And what's the mistake we make? What's the problem there? If we've spent time working on it and preparing it and building it, what do we want to do? We want to show it, even at the expense of the demo, even at the dismay of our customer, right? And then we've got too much to do and too little time, so then we're rushing through the demo. Here's the other thing that I realized. My background is enterprise architecture. I'm an engineer by trade. What do I tend to focus on? The thing, right? We love tinkering. We love the widget. We love the screens and the views and the data and all that. We sort of forget the story. We focus on the shovel and not what they're trying to accomplish. So I'd spend all this time building out all these complicated things and sort of show up and say, so let me show you all these things that I built. Well, they didn't really understand all the things that I built. So what I realized is that first and foremost, I needed to focus on the story. I've sort of gone between the script and the story, but at the end of the day, it's the demo story. What is the key point you're trying to make with your demo? Right? We need to focus on that first. And then let's burn cycles actually building out a customized demo, the content, right? If it's justified, but it needs to be right-sized. You guys have a product background. I'm sure you've heard of the MVP, the minimum viable product. My favorite new term is the MVD, the minimum viable demo. Right? Let's just show what we need to get the technical win. So that's, hopefully that makes sense. That's sort of the history or the background behind habit number three, which is let's just build what we need to tell that compelling story to get the technical win.
Yeah. Resonates very strongly. And I would like to ask you a question out of my daily life, because That's my sentiment. What you just elaborated on is how I would like to operate. And I've heard sentences like, okay, well, it's quite common that 80% of the build we've done, we're not showing, which then tells me, okay, that means we could let go of like 3/4 of our pre-sales people if we would just engage with our prospects better and understand what they would like to see, because then we can get it done much faster, right? And one counter argument that I have heard multiple times from sales is then something like, yeah, but just in case they ask this one question in the meeting, please prepare for that. How would you tackle that?
So, I mean, we probably could do an entire podcast just on that one question.
we could, but this one is a burning question, so I had to ask it.
So my first response is, if we're planning for just in case, we don't know enough about this customer. We haven't done enough discovery. And this isn't a real deal, right? If you think that a just in case is what's going to turn it. I have to just share this interesting story, and I'll make it as brief as I can. You guys have already figured out that my stories get long-winded. But short version of a story, I had the opportunity to go into a sales presentation, actually with a colleague in Madrid, believe it or not. And we were going in, and she didn't know much about this prospect. So she and I, literally the day before, started working together on her slides, and she started throwing in all these things into the slide. And she was like, well, they might want to talk about this, and they might want to. And I went, time out. I said, you've just given me a new model. Here's the model. The less we know going in, the less we should be preparing going in. We should have a couple slides, and then we should really get them to do most of the talking. Right now, the more we know, okay, the more we can prepare. So to the sales counterpart that says the just in case, my response to that is let's focus on the critical few. If there's anything that they ask about that we can't show today, it gives us a reason to just come back another day. So that's my answer to that.
The reality of it is also that in most meetings where we show software and the AE has maybe some role to play, of course, and maybe there's even a third colleague in the room or in the meeting, is also that we are constantly struggling for time, right?
Yeah.
If you do a comprehensive software demo and you have 2 hours, that is quite tough to manage, which means overloading is really not the problem we have to solve there. It's time, more time management.
Well, and it,
so I love the MVD sort of acronym. I love it because that is the sentiment of it.
Well, and it's interesting. I just had this thought, if I can share, and that is, you know, I feel like a lot of times sales engineers are accused of giving the harbor tour. I don't know if you guys have heard that concept, right? And what's interesting to me is that it seems like we have some sales counterparts that want us to almost come in like prepared to give the harbor tour in case what they see, you know, doesn't really align. And it reminds me of another analogy that I created recently, which is take the image of the harbor tour. Now take the image of an Uber driver and think, what does the Uber driver know when he or she picks you up? They know where you are. They know where you want to go. And it's their job to get you there as quickly and concisely as possible. That should be our mantra going into demos, right? Let's make sure we know where they are. Let's make sure we know where they want to go. And let's show them as little as possible to convince them that we can actually get them there. Does that relate, guys?
I'm going to steal that metaphor. I'm going to steal it.
It's all yours, free of charge. And Jan, I'm sorry. I think I might have cut you off, but that idea just had to get out of my brain.
No, I like it. Absolutely no worries. I was just trying to say maybe one response, Tim, to that statement, like just in case, could also question like, Mr. Account Executive, what's your fear, right?
That's good.
So
that's really good.
I mean, trying to understand where he is really coming from or going to, because for the three of us, I don't think it makes sense to just in case preparation, right?
Exactly.
So maybe that's a question you could potentially ask back to have a conversation and hopefully getting to the real why behind that statement.
Yeah. No, that's good. I think I'll borrow that myself, actually. That's really good.
We're stealing from each other.
I love it.
I like it.
I love it.
So with that, I would argue, okay, habit number three, we can put a check mark behind. And then we come to something, I think you've said this actually before, this one term, you labeled it practice, click every click. Software was a story is basically where we're going to head into. So what's hidden behind this one?
Yeah, you know, hopefully people sort of are starting to see a sequence here, right? So we started with the partnership, right? Probe is discovery. Now I'm armed with information about this customer, this opportunity, the project, right? And so now I can prepare. One of the things that I learned about myself was that the last thing that I would budget time for was to actually practice my demo. And I don't know if what I'm about to say resonates with either of you or any of our listeners today, but on more than one occasion, the first time I ran through the entire demo was in front of the customer. That's a huge mistake, right? Why? Because we're always scrambling at the last minute. Like, by the way, just in case, let's add in this. I want to make sure this, right? And here was the biggest thing, and this is where the click every click came from. Without exception, there always seems to have something fail, right? Always seem to have something fail, like at the worst possible time. And what made me crazy is after the fact, I would go in and realize that I missed one little configuration, or I forgot to check one box. And had I just clicked every click 5 or 10 minutes even before the meeting or that morning and saw that one thing, I could have quick gone in and made a change, and then it would have been smooth sailing, right? So, and what I discovered, even when I started spot checking things, I wouldn't click, particularly if it was, again, one of the things I talk about is know your aha moments. You should have 3 to 5 aha moments in every demo where you want the audience to go, wow, like that's what we're looking for, right? Make sure that if there's 5 or 6 clicks, make sure you've tested every one. Don't just pop it up and say, yeah, everything looks good, right? Because things change. So that's really where that came from, was it just got to the point, even when I was being careful, things weren't working at the most inopportune time. And I just said to myself, that's never happening to me again. You know, now, do things still happen? Of course they do, right? And there's ways to handle it. But I just got to the point where, and here's the final word I'll say, and then I'll pause. It's eliminating avoidable mistakes. That's really the bottom line. Let's at least eliminate avoidable mistakes. Stuff's going to happen. People don't expect people to be perfect. People don't expect software to be perfect. But man, I just made myself crazy when I stumbled into something and it was just completely and totally avoidable.
Yeah. So I think, I don't know whether it was a cup or maybe a t-shirt that Jan has been wearing or whatever that says, keep calm, do a dry run, and then do another dry run.
I love that.
I think that's really the conclusion out of this one. And when I read that habit, it also triggered another thought in my mind, something that I've been recently observing on myself because, well, most companies will probably have the same situation, right? Business is a bit tougher right now, which means there was a situation where would I be, maybe I would give like 2-3 demos in a week.
Yeah.
And then maybe all of a sudden I'm now doing only 1 a week or maybe 1 every 2 weeks, right? It's slowing down a little bit. And then I could tell by myself that sort of the talk track that I've actually internalized so very much by doing it 2-3 times a week sort of has weakened because the frequency has gone down. So that practicing even outside of a preparation for a deal where you just do a smooth, or you try to do a smooth demonstration, the general click path that you go through, even though obviously it might change from deal to deal, but there's a general flow probably in place. Practicing that to stay on top of your game is also something I've noticed to be beneficial.
Yeah, no, it's a really good observation. And, you know, I'm inclined to say, and again, this is probably if and when I release the second edition of the book, I'll probably talk about this because I'm the first to admit that in the habit, when I talk about practice, I'm focusing more, a little bit more on the clicks and the mechanics, but you're absolutely right. We need to practice our talk tracks. But there's a fine line. One of the things I tell people, please don't try to remember a script or memorize a script, right? Because then you're focusing too much on yourself and too much on your own words. And that's the last place the focus should be, right? The focus really needs to be on the customer, right? So I've never run a marathon. I don't know if you guys have, but I've been told that as when you're practicing for a marathon, like the month leading up to the marathon, you run like a 15 miler one weekend, and then like a 17 miler, and then a 20 miler or something like that. But you leave that last 6 miles to the day of the race. I think of that as the demo, right? Like you need to have a really good structure in place and know your talk track, but you got to leave that sort of 20% to be a little bit in the moment, right? Extemporaneous. So anyway, just a few more thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I believe you wanted to say something, didn't you?
No, not really. I mean, there's nothing to add. Maybe beside, you need to get the basics right. So yeah. I mean, if and maybe that already resonates into the final habit. If you look at very successful sports people like, I don't know, Michael Jordan, Messi, or Tim Love's Formula One, Lewis Hamilton, right? So I'm pretty sure they practice the basics a lot, right? To be able to get beyond a normal level. And for us watching it looks like, oh, it looks so easy, right? But they wouldn't be able to perform it in such an kind of relaxed way if they wouldn't practice day in and day out the basic skills they need to be successful.
Well, and it's so interesting you should say that, Jan. So in the workshops that I run, I actually have in this segment, I have a video of Kobe Bryant talking about practice. And I would encourage our listeners, Google Kobe Bryant talking about practice. It's about a 90-second, you know, bit, but it's so powerful what he has to say about practice. And he talks about pushing himself and pushing others. It's really, so your words are spot on. Even the best of the best practice relentlessly.
I'll try to find that video on YouTube and I'll put it in the show notes for our listeners.
Yeah, it's fabulous.
And they can check it out. Awesome. Yeah, so, I mean, Jan, you already sort of hinted at going into the next point, which is, again, of course, another P, right? Perform. Demo best practices. And, well, to be honest, when I read that, the first thing that comes to mind, which is obviously good old Robert Riefenstahl, something like a TST loop, right? I don't know if that's something that you also talk about, or maybe you have a different similar concept or something like that. But what type of best practices do you have in mind?
Yeah, and so, you know, Tim, it's so funny. I mean, to be fair, I probably could have written the book just on chapter 5. I mean, this is all around the what I call the customer-facing skills, regardless of how effective the partnership is, regardless of how well we've done our discovery, right? How well we've probed and prepared and practiced, right? Whether good or bad, at some point, the spotlight shines on us. As there's no place to hide, right? The entire room's looking at us, and it's now our time. This is where, to me, this is where our role really as a professional pre-sales individual, right? A professional software demonstration, you know, individual sort of come to bear. And one of the things that I learned about myself was that I had to shift my thinking a little bit from the post-sales presentation to a pre-sales presentation. I was a consultant and an expert in my field and an expert on the product that the vendor that I went to work for. And I think early on, a lot of my demos were more like training and consulting. And what I discovered is that there's some very specific things that we need to do and say, and there are some very specific things that we need to avoid doing and saying in order to get the technical win. And so habit 5 is really all around those customer-facing skills. And they fall into sort of three categories, and I'll just sort of give just a few examples. It's really, what do I do before I launch into my demo? So one is get consensus in the room, get agreement in the room. So my understanding is your requirements are this, you're trying to accomplish this, your objective is this, and we're here to talk about this, or I'm here to demonstrate this. And typically that's going to follow my sales counterpart, so I'm going to tie it back to what he or she has said, right? Are we all on the same page here? Is everybody in agreement, right? Why? I want to make sure everybody in the room understands. I'm sort of setting scope. This is what we're here to talk about, right? Another one is know the players. Before you launch into your demo, know who's who. Where's the center of the room, right? The key sort of stakeholder or decision maker. Where are your technical principals? Maybe there are some technical influencers. Maybe there are some, quote, users who have a different perspective. Maybe there are some what I call uninvited guests, right? People from down the hall where they said, hey, the guys from SAP are coming into the meeting or, you know, coming to give a demo. Why don't you just come and listen, right? Why? Because questions from those individuals or questions from any of those individuals need to be handled differently, depending who they are and whether or not it's in scope with the agreed upon, right, scope. Let me pause there. Does that resonate with you guys?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, I like the way you put it, right? You have different categories for these type of best practice. And there's probably, I mean, you said it yourself, right? We could fill another episode just on this one. Or you said you could fill another book on itself, right? Just on demo best practices. And maybe a little challenge. We didn't discuss this beforehand, but maybe do you have one like a tactical best practice in mind where you would say the majority of pre-sales people are really not thinking about this or struggling with this? Is that something that comes to mind?
I'd say the one that comes to mind most readily is how they respond or how we respond to questions.
Right.
I think that's the biggest. And I say this in the book. I believe that the way in which we respond to questions makes or breaks the deal, or at least makes or breaks the demo.
Right.
Why? Because we know what we're going to say going in. Right? We know what our plan is. We know what our script is. We know what our story is. What do we not know? What do we not see coming? Whatever questions they might have to throw at us. And the way in which we handle those questions, I think, makes the biggest difference. And I've created, and I don't know if you guys have looked with it or not, I've created a sort of a grid or a matrix for how to respond to questions based on two key things, right? First is who's asking the question. Are they critical to the decision-making process, or are they really not a critical individual just in terms of the decision-making process, right? Number two, is this in scope of what we've said, this is what we're here to talk about today, or is it out of scope, right? You put those two things together and that dictates how I respond. So let's take a look at a couple of them, right? An individual who's not necessarily critical to the deal asks a question that's out of scope. What's the mistake we make? We spend 10 minutes answering that question to the dismay of everybody else in the room when they're thinking to themselves, why are we even spending time talking about this, right? When I get that question from that individual, I'm going to dismiss it as politely and quickly as possible. Let's take an example. Bob from down the hall. He shows up at one, you know, and he asks a question that's something that's completely and totally irrelevant. I may find the middle of the room, Tim, let's say you're the leader. I may turn to Tim and say, gee, Tim, the question Bob has just asked is an interesting one, but I don't recall this being part of the requirements. Is this something we should spend some time talking about? More than likely, Tim's going to look at Bob and say, Bob, we're not here to talk about that today, right? And I'm off the hook, right? Now, if Tim says, well, actually, Chris, yes, I'm sorry that hasn't come up before as a requirement, but that's actually something that at some point we're going to need to talk about. Well, guess what? It's now in a different quadrant. It's now Tim, who's a critical decision maker, out of scope. If I fall in that category, now I might drop into discovery, right? Like, oh, okay, Tim, we haven't talked about that before. Help me understand how important that is, right? Let's go back to Bob. Bob asks a question. It's in scope, but it's a little bit sort of off my path, right? And in my mind, I'm thinking to myself, you know, I'm going to cover that in about 10 minutes, right? I might defer that question, right? And just say, Bob, glad you asked. That's an important question. If I could ask you to just hold that for a moment, I'm pretty sure I'll cover that before I'm finished. But by the way, if I don't, you know, call me out on it, right? And now I can continue. The last quadrant, and then I'll pause, is the critical decision, key decision maker asks a question that's in scope, right? the mistake that we make is we'll defer that question. We'll say the same thing to Tim that we did to Bob, right? And say, Tim, if you could just hold that question for 5 or 10 minutes, right? Well, what have I just told Tim? My agenda is more important than his question, right? I've just assaulted the most important person in the room, right? When I get that question in that quadrant, I give that my direct attention, right? So what are the four quadrants? Dismiss, defer, discover, direct attention. Do you follow that, guys?
Yeah, it's a great model. Resonates very well with me personally. And one thought that I had just now when you were telling that story around answering Bob's more or less irrelevant question for 10 minutes. One thing that I've observed is even if the question is relevant, right? And I would say most of the questions have some relevance of a certain degree to some extent. But one thing that I've seen also is that sometimes we go out, well, let me phrase it differently. We answer just too long. The answer is just too long, right? Sometimes a simple yes, and here's why, and then you maybe provide one sentence as opposed to having a long monologue that goes like even 5 minutes is, I would argue in most cases, probably too long, right? Whereas a simple yes would have been sufficient, right? And then you go there into software, you go into the submenu, you open this one up and you prove it. And yes, there is the proof, but a simple yes would have been fine. Let's move on. And finding that right balance, how deep must I go in my answer, is also something that I've personally also struggled with. So I guess, yeah, also experience plays a role here. And reflecting on these points that you just mentioned.
Yeah. Well, and if I may, and you guys are starting to pick this up, I'm sure your listeners are too. I've got little alliteration models for all these things, right? So for what you were just saying, I've actually got a little sort of alliteration model trick for that. So somebody asks me a question that's maybe somewhat of a one-off, right? And I can, and to your point, the mistake that we make is we go, oh yeah, we can do that. Let me show you. Click, 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 right? And then 10 minutes later, the person says, so the answer was yes, right? So how do we respond to that? First, provide a verbal answer. Can we do such and such? Indeed, we can. Yeah. That'll satisfy 50, if not 80% of the questions, right? Well, can I see that? Can you show that to us? Okay. I do what's called give visual evidence, right? I'm not going to click, click, click. Maybe I'll show them a menu option, right? Maybe I'll just show them the dropdown or show where it is. I'm not going to click into it. I'm just going to show that. Like if they, you know, can you export to Excel? If they just see the word Excel, they're like, okay, I'm good, right? At that point, I've probably answered 95% of the question. But somebody may persist and say, well, can we actually see how it works? Okay, now I need to decide how important is this individual to the decision-making process? How important is this to the agreed upon requirements? And if I need to, I go into vivid detail if it's appropriate. So verbal response, visual evidence, vivid detail.
Yeah, it's great guidance. I love it. So we've checked, I think now 5 P's, and sort of the last P, which is perfect constant improvement, we somewhat discussed already because we got into a discussion in habit number 2 or 3, I think.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything to add to that. I think the general sentiment was basically providing feedback to each other, right? We learned, okay, sales is a team sport, so to say. So there's always multiple people involved with different perspectives, which means we can learn from each other. And that will lead to constant improvement if we have the culture to give each other constructive feedback. So I think that was sort of the conclusion we had there. Do you want to put anything on top of that?
Yeah, I mean, there's probably two things that I'll mention. The first is I want to emphasize that it's a verb and not a noun. And why do I say that? I think if we strive to create the perfect demo, we're A, never going to get there. And B, we're not making the best use of our time.
Right.
When we're preparing for a demo, perfect is the enemy of good enough. Perfect is the enemy of MVD, in my opinion. So I want to really emphasize the point that what we're talking about here is the verb to constantly and consistently seek to be perfecting our craft, right? Our perfecting our message. And then the second thing I want to mention is is it's also in the context of finding workarounds for those known shortcomings and those known sort of, let's call it flaws in the software. Here's the reality. No software platform, package, product is perfect. It's just not. There, with every company I've ever worked for or with, there are certain requirements that the solution just notoriously doesn't address or satisfy. And invariably, those things never seem to get answered. And everybody sort of has a different answer. So to me, it's again, we'll use another P word. It's being taking a proactive stance. And particularly if you're in a demo and somebody asks a question that, frankly, the solution doesn't have a good answer for, go do some homework and figure out a satisfactory workaround for that shortcoming. So the next time you're asked that question, you at least have an answer and or something you can pull out. So that's the second aspect of that. Does that make sense?
It does. And I'm going to add another word with a P, because that's something that Jan has introduced to me, at least in the context of pre-sales, which is Pareto, right? So don't fall into the trap of bringing 100% every single time, because perfectionism will be a huge time killer, right? So 80% of the result is resulting out of 20% of what you've put in, right? And then the last 20% is just a lot of more effort to get to 100. So just by having that consciousness already is important to be effective in your role, right? As a pre-sales person.
Yeah,
right?
So. Indeed.
I would like to add one thing, at least that's my experience, especially that last point. So constant improvement, right? Or trying to learn each and every day. I think that is also a huge responsibility of leadership.
Mm.
So creating a kind of environment where people feel secure, safe, to be able to perform in that way, right? Because maybe especially in Germany, feedback is often taken like, oh, you would like to do me a bad thing, right? Mm-hmm. I normally see it as a gift, right? So for that reason, I think there's a huge responsibility from a leadership perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point, right? I think leadership needs to, A, make it okay to not be perfect, right? Number one, and I think leadership needs to not only look for but facilitate opportunities for their people to get that professional development. Sometimes it's just facilitating the conversation between sales and pre-sales, and then us as sales engineers, we need to check our ego at the door, right? We need to be open to feedback and accept. By the way, and again, from personal experience, I know that there were times in my career where I tried to be perfect and I would get hung up if I didn't give the perfect demo. And I had to accept that, you know what? It's like there's no such thing as perfection and things aren't always going to work. And it is what it is. So, and you can always just, you know, learn to do better. So.
And I think that's a pretty good closing statement. And at that stage, I would like to hand over, because I can already see. So for the listeners, while we're having this conversation, of course, we have a Google Doc, which is our guideline for this conversation. And Jan has been busy typing some conclusion together, which I'm very excited about to hear. So word to you, Jan, if you want to guide us through the conclusion of the conversation for today.
Absolutely. It's definitely time for real-time conclusion. So let me try to summarize what we talked about for the last 60 minutes already, something like that.
Yeah, it's been 60 minutes around. Yeah.
So we need each other, right? And it starts really with respect, trust, and good communication, or at least understanding for the other stakeholders, right? So it's really a partnership to be successful. Be curious and get a real understanding of what your customer is looking for, by the way, as a team. Focus on the story, right? Compelling and also valuable to your customer. And justify it beforehand. I really like the claim minimal viable demo. In my words, less is more, and try to focus on the wow moments for your customer. Do your try run, from my perspective, as early as possible. Sharpen your story. Ideally, have your customer champion included into the try run and make sure that your solution works in front of the customer. So get the basics right, as you said, Chris, click by click. With my words, minimize the risk of failure, right?
Yep.
And then the part you should really enjoy every single time, in brackets, if your preparation was done the right way. Showtime in front of your customer. And you mentioned very one important part, handle your customer's questions the right way. Otherwise, it could really break your deal. Try to improve constantly and see constructive feedback as a lovely gift for yourself and for others. Full stop.
Well done. I like it. Real-time conclusion. Thank you very much, Jan. And with that being said, Chris, if the listeners are really excited and interested in the things that you have here talked about today, of course, we would like them to contact you, reach out, right? I mean, this is really what you do on a day-to-day basis. How can listeners reach you?
Yeah, it is indeed. Of course, they can reach out to me on LinkedIn. Pretty easy to find, Chris White. And if they go to demodoctor.com, and some browsers struggle with justice of www.demodoctor.com. In fact, they can pick up a free first chapter of the book if they're interested in that.
Perfect.
At /free chapter. So just demodoctor.com/free chapter. And of course, if they're interested in the book, The 6 Habits of Highly Effective Sales Engineers is available on Amazon.
Yeah, great. So we'll put, of course, your LinkedIn profile in the show notes, if that's all right with you. We'll put the demodoctor.com URL in there, including the free first chapter and also the Amazon link. So if people are curious to learn more, they can go there. And with that being said, Chris, it has been a pleasure. I really enjoyed this conversation. It was a lot of fun. I learned something again, which is great. And I hope, of course, our dear listeners also could take something away. And again, I'm relating back to my housekeeping statement. If you did, let us know. This is what motivating Jan and myself to continue with these shows and with these episodes that gets us great guests like Chris on this podcast. And so thank you, Chris. Thanks for joining us. It has been a pleasure. And I hope we can stay in touch.
For sure. Thank you so much, guys. It's just been a pleasure. And as you can tell, I this is a topic I love speaking on. So delighted to have the opportunity. Thank you.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.